Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I wrote a book about 25 years ago on depression. And the most recent version of that has just been published. If I connect my technology here, you might get some help with this. But after that was published, just in the year or so after that, it was almost like the Lord saying to me, "You think you know a thing about depression? Let me show you. You've studied psychiatry and you've been a Christian for many years, and you think you know about these things, and you've counseled many people, and I have worked as a psychiatrist for a while, and then worked in the Labrie Fellowship, counseling and pastoring for about 14 years in England, and now I teach at Covenant Seminary in St. Louis, teaching people about counseling, both pastors and counseling students." And what happened in the next few years, this was that my sister died in childbirth, which is a pretty rare thing to happen nowadays. My wife got cancer. Thankfully, she has been completely cured from that. My father-in-law died. My brother-in-law, after his wife died, 3 years later on the anniversary of her death, he took his own life. And so it went on. There were difficulties in work, difficulties in relationships. I was in positions of leadership and responsibility. I was gradually sort of dying on the vine, if you know that expression. I was burning out, and I began to spiral down into this dark place that I'd never been to before. And it was a frightening place. And I began to understand subjectively what I had been talking about and reading about and writing about. So I share with you both sort of knowledge that I've learned over the years in counseling and pastoring, but also somewhat in my own experience. Thankfully, I didn't stay there very long, but I have a lot more empathy now for people who do go down into this place of darkness. And of course, depression has a huge cost in terms of lost hours at work, of marriage breakdown, physical health. There are all sorts of repercussions from serious depression. And the question comes for us, of course, is depression sickness or sin? One quite well-known counselor has said depression, well, quite a lot of counselors now say, and psychiatrists would say, depression is a mental illness that needs treatment. Others, a Christian counselor says depression is a sin. You just need to repent and get your life together and pray more and have more faith, and you will get over it. Others have said depression is a result of a failure of self-control and self-discipline. Now, as you look at these, you can see there is some element of truth in all of them, but none of them are a good enough explanation purely on their own. So my first point in all this is that depression is complicated. It's the end point of the result of many different factors in life. And there are many different, for each individual of you in this room, if you get depressed, I guarantee each of your stories will be very different. But you may end up at that point of being quite seriously depressed. We talk about an epidemic of depression, and I think that's partly true, that there is an increase in depression. But it's partly just that it's being diagnosed a lot more now. And also the pharmaceutical industry funds the research, and they want everyone to be diagnosed so they can sell their pills to you. This was a New Yorker magazine cartoon, and the caption is, "No wonder you feel good. These are loaded with antidepressants." Now, there's also been an epidemic of depression in young people, more and more young people being diagnosed with depression. And is that a real epidemic, or is it just that more are being diagnosed? That's a big question that we are not completely sure of. But I think it's really helpful to think about in our emotions and our depression. When we think about depression, we're talking about anything from just feeling blue, feeling a bit down, feeling a bit low at one end of the spectrum, and mild depression, sadness, discouragement, grief, frustration, all of these can be on that spectrum. And then you go deeper down into depression and you have what we call severe depression, verging into what we call clinical or major depression in the psychiatric medical world. And this is much more severe, and I think it's important to understand the signs of severe depression, and to understand why some people are more vulnerable to it than others, some are more predisposed, so that we can understand where we are on the spectrum. When we get blue and down and depressed, not all depression is severe, serious depression. But when it is really severe, it is something that people who've been in it describe like this. It's an interior pain that's all but indescribable. That's William Styron in Darkness Visible. It's a veritable howling tempest of the brain. It's like something gets hold of you. When I was going, when I was going through a particularly stressful period of time and I was very anxious about something, I could feel myself slipping down. I said to my wife, I feel like a ship going down, sinking in the ocean. I'm losing a grip on my mind. Something is grabbing my emotions, and I can't control my anxiety and my sense of sadness, and I would cry very easily. Thankfully, again, I didn't slip too far into that whirlpool of depression, but it felt pretty nasty as I was slipping down. Of course, some people get to the point of being so depressed that they think of committing suicide. The pain grew and grew, and I began to experience suicidal thoughts. I realized that life for me was at a desperate impasse. I thought of the garage as a place where I might sit in the car and inhale carbon monoxide. I'd look at the rafters in the attic and think of them as places where I might hang myself. I looked at sharp objects as being implements for my wrist. That's the really serious end of the depressive scale, and I'll come back to suicide a little later on. Those of us who are in the clinical world, tend to have some signs that we look for when we're diagnosing serious, what we call clinical depression. When you know that you as a pastor need to refer to someone who has more experience in counseling and maybe giving medication. And the signs are these: a depressed mood and or loss of pleasure. So they may not actually say they feel depressed for at least 2 weeks. So it's not just a day or two or a day here and there, but this must be at least 2 weeks and almost every day. This is somewhat arbitrary, but it's a helpful sort of gives you a sense of the important signs. And at least four of the following: appetite and weight disturbance, so people may lose their desire to eat as much. Sleep disturbance, they may wake very early in the morning at 3 and can't get back to sleep. Or for younger people especially, they may sleep on in through the day and not want to. They may sleep on till noon. It's just an exaggeration of the normal for that age group. Fatigue, loss of energy, just sitting in a chair, watching TV, unable to concentrate, not interested in doing anything else. And some people, though, become very anxious when they are depressed, and they become restless and agitated. So that might be another way in which it presents itself. And people may feel inappropriate guilt. They feel guilty about something that really they have not really done anything wrong. I had one man in his late 60s who had a stroke, and then he got depressed. And when he was depressed, he was a doctor. He began to ruminate, to think all the time about a patient that he felt he had treated badly 30 years ago. and he couldn't get this out of his mind. But of course, you may get depressed when you really have done things wrong, and it might be a cause, guilt might be a cause of depression. And when we're depressed, often we find it hard to make decisions, we can't concentrate very well, our thinking feels very sort of sticky and heavy. And sometimes then we become suicidal. And if the depression gets really bad, then you may believe that you have cancer when you don't. Or I had one patient who believed that she was giving off a terrible smell that other people could smell, but nobody else could smell it. It was a delusional idea. Others who believe they're being followed by the KGB or the CIA, paranoid ideas. And for Christians who get depressed, there's often this additional element that prayer seems to be useless, and reading the Bible just doesn't make any sense, and they feel like their prayers get no further than the ceiling. So eventually they give up and don't bother anymore. God seems so far away. Now, it's important to understand when you talk to someone and you listen to their story, you need to listen why and what might be the reasons. And what is it that they're talking about to be able to evaluate how serious this depression is? And in one study that was done, people were prescribed, 43% were prescribed antidepressants, but had no psychiatric diagnosis or any mental health care beyond the prescription of drugs. So if you go to a general practitioner with depression, you're very likely to be prescribed drugs after a 20-minute interview. And he'll probably not want you to come back again. That's bad practice. Because people really need to, they may not need the medication, and B, they should be followed up. Because the best treatment for depression is antidepressants and talking to someone and counseling. So why is it that women seem to get depressed twice as often as men? This is partly that men and women express depression differently. So it may be that we pick up, women talk about depression more. And I'll come to that in a moment. But I think that women are genuinely more vulnerable, more predisposed to depression. Partly because we see that they're more predisposed to this in puberty and around childbirth and at menopause when hormones are obviously changing. The men don't have to deal with that. Women tend to be more sensitive in relationships and to the loss of relationships. They have experienced more abuse than men. And they tend to experience more cultural oppression. And obviously in some cultures, we see that very extremely. A lot of oppression in India and many Muslim cultures. And women tend to express their sadness openly with crying, with feelings of worthlessness, talking about guilt and shame. Whereas men tend to, they might withdraw, they've lost interest in their work or their marriage or their children. They're often more irritable and angry. They're often harshly self-critical. They may have problems at their work. They may have physical problems of illness. But they don't talk and say, I am depressed. Or often they're not very well, not perhaps as in touch with their feelings. So they don't. It's not so obvious that they are struggling with depression. And they're more ashamed of it because men shouldn't be depressed. Men shouldn't cry in most cultures. So men tend to, how do they deal with depression? They work harder, at least they try to, or they turn to alcohol for self-medication or drugs or sex or affairs. Or suicide. And men successfully commit suicide 4 times as often as women. There are a lot more men in jail than women. There are more women in psychiatric hospitals than men. It all sort of adds up to the ways we express it. Whereas women will more often, not always, because still there is shame in some cultures, they will talk, they will have friends, a circle of friends, they're not so isolated. They may be more willing to go to a counselor or a doctor if they are available. So let's go back then to this idea of the mood spectrum, but here we have to add in the other end of the mood spectrum, because you know we talk about bipolar disorder or manic depression is the old name for that. But some people both experience the downside when everything is slowed up and depressed and low, but they may also have a predisposition to everything being speeded up. So some of you, I'm sure, have seen people with mania. And there are some people who are just very enthusiastic people, excitable people. That's not mania, that's just their personality. But they may be very exuberant people, that's temperament. But that merges into a disorder that we call mania. And then you have the normal range of happiness and sadness, and then the other end, you have severe depression. And some people can go from one to the other. And those are the swings, the roller coaster swings of bipolar disorder. Some people get repetitive severe depressions and have a few little touch of mania now and again. Some people only get mania and don't get very depressed. So there are lots of variations of this. And the depressive side is sort of what I've described already of the hopelessness and despair. And in the middle, you may have grief, frustration, disappointment, discouragement. So not all depression is depression with a big D. It doesn't need antidepressants. It's only the very serious depression that may really benefit from antidepressants. And in the manic end, you have when people are talking a lot, they're not sleeping, they're giving out money in the streets. I had one patient who was doing that. They may go and use their credit card to get into huge debt. They may be sexually promiscuous. They may, as a Christian who is manic, they may have special words from the Lord and prophecies for the church and feel they have a gift of healing. They often feel very powerful and very happy. They feel they're being very creative. And so they don't really want to be treated because they feel like God and all their problems are over. So it's quite difficult when you have someone like that. Now, if we think then, so we've been talking about this severe depression. If you think of the way the Bible talks about depression, because obviously there are characters in Scripture who were affected by their circumstances very severely. And just a few of them to mention here. Remember the Jeremiah in Lamentations, who talks about God making him walk in darkness. My soul is downcast within me. Or in Psalm 13, how long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day, day after day, have sorrow in my heart? Or Psalm 22, which is obviously a prophetic psalm, but this was the psalmist's experience of God forsaking him. My tears have been my food day and night. And then Psalm 88 is the one psalm that ends in complete darkness. All the others come through to a place of trust again. But here, and we don't know how long it takes the psalmist to get through to a place of trust. Now, I'm not saying that all these people had clinical, severe depression, but they had something pretty close to it. They had an episode in their life when things were pretty dark. If you think of Job in chapter 30, and now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. When I hoped for good, evil came, and when I waited for light, darkness came. My inward parts are in turmoil and never still. That's a pretty good description of what we've been describing, isn't it? Now, we know the reasons for Job's depression, incredible grief and sadness, and maybe we will get in question time perhaps to talk about the difference between grief and depression. And if you go on and think about, so Job's experience was the loss of his family, his farm, his wealth. Think of Elijah, and he was exhausted after his encounter with the prophets of Baal. And then he comes down and then he has Jezebel's death threat, and he runs as fast as he can, hundreds of miles out into the desert, and asks God, essentially says to God, I want to die, I've had enough. Just as Moses gets to the point of saying, when he is caught between the anger of God and the frustration and anger of the people in the desert, Moses says, Lord, I've had enough. If this is the way life is going to be, take my life. And the same with Jonah. He's so angry that God doesn't come through and judge Nineveh in the way that he had said it was going to happen. And God forgives, God has grace, and Jonah doesn't like this God, and so he says, I don't want to be on this mission, God. Take my life. I'd rather be dead. Now, I don't think these people were clinically depressed, but they had that sort of impulsive feeling that can happen to all of us when we want to escape from a difficult situation. And some people genuinely do take their lives impulsively when they want to get out of a really difficult situation. And we think historically of men, of God, and other non-Christians who have experienced depression. Martin Luther struggled with it and wrote quite vividly about it. William Cowper, the great English hymn writer, we still sing some of his hymns. He went through some very severe times. In his teenage years, he tried to commit suicide several times. And the last 7 years of his life, he was pretty severely depressed. Charles Spurgeon, the great preacher, Abraham Lincoln, I'll come back to him in a while, and Winston Churchill talked about his depression as his black dog that followed him around and occasionally would take over. And there are plenty of women, too, in history. Christina Rossetti, Emily Dickinson, some other well-known film stars and singers and writers, Judy Garland, Gwyneth Paltrow, Amy Tan, and J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter author. They all speak or have written openly about times of severe depression. And then, of course, Abraham Lincoln. And just recently with the... How many of you have seen the film of Lincoln, the recent one? Just a few of you. I would strongly urge you to see it. It is a magnificent film. And I would encourage you to read the history of the American Civil War a little bit before you go, because it's quite dense with content. But it gives you a real feel of Lincoln and his melancholy disposition. And it only shows about 6 or 7 years, the last 6 or 7 years of his life. But it's really intriguing to read about his life and see how he fits this picture of episodes of severe depression and some of the predisposing causes. His mother so there are genetic influence. His mother was a woman who suffered from pervasive sadness, and she died when he was age 9. So two things: there's a genetic predisposition, there's a loss of a very significant person in his early years. His brother died in infancy, and then his only sister, who he was very fond of, who was a bit older than him, died when she was 20 after giving birth to a stillborn child. And then at the age of 26, he had his first episode of severe depression. And this was related particularly to a good friend of his, a woman that he was... People speculate about how close he was to her. Nobody's quite sure, but he used to visit her every day when she was sick. So it must have been pretty close. And she eventually died. And then soon after that, there was really terrible weather. And it's interesting that the historians comment that Lincoln was very sensitive to the weather, as some people are. And there were extreme cold and wet winters at this particular time. So he and the people around him said, this guy is crazy. They actually, his friends locked him up in his room because they were so afraid that he would kill himself. So he was in serious depression. His second episode, and by the way, severe depression is commonly occurs in the 20s, between 20 and 30, the first episode. It can occur younger, but this is pretty common. The second episode of his depression, when he was 31, was after he split up with his fiancée, who he later did marry, Mary Todd, and he also had an incredibly heavy workload. He had trained himself to be a lawyer, with not even going to school. He homeschooled himself. He was so brilliant. Became a lawyer at the age of 28, and then had a very heavy workload. And his best friend, John Speed, left at that time, and they broke up and had a sort of difficult relationship at that time. And again, there was another winter of terrible weather. And he sunk into this really severe, almost craziness of mind. But through it all, he sort of kept working. And then the third depression, it was almost like he had learned somehow to manage his own temperament and his own vulnerability as he matured as a person. Now, Lincoln was not, it seems, not a believer, and he became a free thinker. His parents came from a very narrow, strict Baptist sect. So he grew up with a sort of hyper-Calvinism, which he rejected. Later in his life, he came back to really what I would call liberal Presbyterianism. He used to go to church. He believed in God. But I don't think he was what we would call a true believer. And so he managed. He didn't get so severely depressed. He had a lot of marriage difficulties. His wife was a woman who suffered from rages. She could get very angry, and she was very up and down. He was absent a lot. And when she got really angry at him, he would just withdraw and go quiet. And of course, that just polarized them and made them worse. He then got a seat in Congress, so he went to Washington and was away from home a lot. Then their son died at the age of 3. His father died, and he had a difficult relationship with his father, a distant relationship. So he didn't even go to his father's funeral. He didn't go to his father's bedside when he was dying. Shows you the distance there was from them. So here we have difficult relationship. He lost of mother, difficult relationship with father, incredibly bright, sensitive young man, multiple losses in his life. And then, very unexpectedly, he was elected president of the United States. I mean, an incredible trajectory in his life. And then he went to war, and he took on, it's at this stage in his life that he found the cause and a real meaning for his life, which was to fight slavery. And I think that gave him a strength and a resilience that enabled him to ignore the depressions. He had a reason to live. And he fought slavery passionately, and he took the country to war over slavery, and a war that was horrible. His fellow countrymen were killing each other, and he had to go through the battlefields and see them lying there, carnage around him. And then during the war, his 11-year-old son died of an infectious disease. So the poor man, and you see, you have these pictures of Lincoln just sort of his head down, very severe look. He would sit for hours in this sort of withdrawn, depressed state of mind. And nobody would get through to him. He would just sit there until he came out of it. But I think you see in him someone who was incredibly resilient, who developed ways of dealing with his depression that, under the common grace of God, that somehow worked for him. And what was amazing was that he would talk about his depression. And I think that was a key. He would talk about it to people, and he wasn't ashamed of it, which is amazing if you think of politicians today. Secondly, he would write about it, write poetry. And his poetry was always very depressive. Thirdly, he would read a lot, Shakespeare. And you can imagine the plays that were his favorites, Hamlet, Macbeth, Richard III, all the depressive plays. And he read the book of Job. So that's a little about Lincoln, but he's a really interesting case study. And there is a book called Lincoln's Melancholy, which is, I have the author's name here. I'm trying to remember what it is now. I can get it if anyone wants it. Now, so depression is not something new. It's not something as if we've discovered it. Back in the 1600s, well, back throughout history, people have been writing about it. Richard Baxter, a pastor at that time, had a very sophisticated understanding of the relation, the interaction between biology and psychology and spiritual factors. He recognized that in severe depression, there seemed to be some sort of biological factor. John Calhoun, in the 1800s, describes people with depression almost exactly as the way we would describe them today, and wrote this small book on the nature and signs of melancholy in the true Christian. So if we think it now in biblical categories, we use, in English anyway, we talk about the battle against the world and the flesh and the devil. Yeah? These are our main enemies, the sinful, broken world. The flesh, which means either our body or our inner psychological state, and the devil. I mean, so this is from a biblical perspective, we can say we live in a fallen world where we are all affected by Adam and Eve's sin. Things came into the world, such as illness of body and brain, genetic disorders, so that things happen to you, cancer may come to you, depression, schizophrenia may come to you through no fault of your own. We also live in a sinful world where you may be the victim of other people's sin. So your parents may abuse you. Your parents may be alcoholics. And this wounds you. It scars you, your psyche. They may get divorced and leave you when you are a young child. And then you have your own sin that may bring bad things to you. If you live a life of sexual addiction, that's going to change your brain. If you live a life of alcoholism, that's going to change your brain. And then we have our sinful reaction to other people's sin. When we think under the category of the flesh, we think of our sinful nature, our selfishness, our pride, our desire to be in control, our lack of trust, our tendency to idolatry. These are all the sort of the bent of our inner mind towards sin and self-centeredness. And then we also think of our biology. Our flesh in the Greek, in the New Testament, the word sarx is translated as either sinful nature or body. So your brain chemistry may go wrong. Your hormones may go wrong. And then you have the devil. And of course, we have glimpses all through Scripture of Job in the invisible battle that he didn't know anything about. We have the devil described as someone who is a liar, a deceiver, an accuser, a destroyer. We are all involved in spiritual warfare. And part of that may be that the devil knows your point of weakness. If your vulnerability is anxiety or depression or sexual addiction, he will attack you at that point. Now, if we then move from the biblical categories to the secular, psychological, and medical categories, there are some parallels, but they're not exact parallels, but in the world of, we talk about the psychological and social and biological causes of depression. And just a few things that I'm going to go through quite fast in this. Some people are just temperamentally predisposed to be negative thinkers, to be what we call glass half empty people. If you read Winnie the Pooh, they are the Eeyores of this life. Some people are more perfectionist in their temperament and in their thinking patterns. And if you are a perfectionist, you tend to think in very all or nothing, black and white ways about the world. So if you fail at something, then you think, I should never do this again, I'm a hopeless failure. Or if you... And perfectionists tend to need to be in control of life. Now, we're not in control all the time in our lives, and when we get out of control, we get anxious and we get depressed. So learning to live with uncertainty is a part of living in a fallen world, isn't it? And then some people are just temperamentally and genetically more prone to anxiety. I can see that in my children and my grandchildren. Some are just much more anxious than others. Some are more pessimistic, as I've said. Some of us tend to repress our anger. We don't know how to deal with anger very well. We stuff it all inside. And that can be a cause over the long term of depression. And then the other things I mentioned of self-centeredness and pride and envy. Now, when we are doing counseling, or when you're doing pastoral care, these are the areas that we tend to focus on, don't we? We talk about how people deal with anxiety, or how they are dealing with anger, or pride, or envy. So this is part of the sort of the talking treatment, and also helping people to be aware of what their temperament is. You have to learn to live with your God-given temperament, both how it is created and how it is fallen from its original intention. And then there are things that happen sociologically, in other words, things that happen to us. You may be a child of divorce. You may have suffered abuse or neglect, or a life of chronic stress, or you may, like Abraham Lincoln, have losses in your early life of people, important people, or you may lose your house because you can't afford to keep it anymore. You may lose your job. You may lose all your money in the stock market. You may lose your dreams, your dream of being a doctor or a lawyer or a rich businessman or a pastor, and have to let go of dreams. So losses are a big part of a cause of depression. How we deal with loss is a really important thing to learn in life. How we deal with failure is really important in life. And then having some sort of meaning and purpose in life is really important too. And I think for Abraham Lincoln, he was just finding his purpose in being a lawyer and then a politician and then eventually this incredible fight against slavery that he got involved in. Now the suicide statistics in the United States show this peak in old age, so over 75, over 70 it goes up. There's also a peak in midlife, when I think people are facing, what have I done with my life? What's the meaning of my life? As they look back and they look ahead. Certain countries are more vulnerable, so the red countries here are the ones that have higher rates of suicide. So in the, particularly the countries that have been more atheistic in Eastern Europe and Russia, there is a much higher rate, and Western Europe now is going up. Now, again, it's some countries it's hard to get accurate statistics. But just because we're in Europe right now, and you may be interested, this is the UK has 9.6 per 100,000. The Russian Federation, 39 per 100,000. And then Serbia has had a recent steep rise in the mid years of 65 out of 100,000. So that's a lot of people committing suicide. In average, over the average in the UK, it's about 1 to 2% of the population who commit suicide. That's a lot of people. And men 3 to 4 times as often, as I mentioned earlier, and women attempt suicide 2 to 3 times more than men, often over relationship problems and difficulties with loss, and in a sense asking for help with that. Now, the rise in the elderly, if you think what's happening in the life of old people, they often are dealing with serious chronic physical illness. They often have severe or chronic pain. They have many losses. They're losing their friends. They're losing family. They're facing death themselves. And they're quite often socially isolated. So there's every reason for them to be more vulnerable at that age. And their brains are beginning biologically to begin to deteriorate. So the brains are more vulnerable. So what's important in all this is to recognize that even though bad things may happen to us, a lot of bad things happened to Abraham Lincoln and to some other of these other Christian people that I've referred to, but somehow they managed through their perspective to deal with the depression. And the times when I've felt myself going down, I've had to say, you know, I am vulnerable in this area. I need to take precautions. I need to do things that help me to increase my resistance, my resilience. And we'll come to those in a minute. But it's not so much what happens to us, but how we view what happens. And those who are depressed tend to notice negative things a lot more than non-depressed people. So you have to learn to notice the positive things. That's part of the treatment, part of the therapy. And our view is affected by our genetic structure, our life experience, our maturity, our relationship with God. So your perspective, the glasses through which you see the world, are affected by all of these things. So just for a moment, let me say a little bit more about the biological, because time is going by fast here. There is a genetic predisposition to severe depression. So in identical twin, if you have an identical twin who has severe depression, you have a 50% likelihood of having depression yourself. It's much less if you don't have the same genetic structure. And even in children who've been adopted into other families, if their biological parents have depression, they're more likely to be depressed, even if they're adopted at birth, than their adoptive siblings. And we find that we don't fully understand the mechanism of depression, but it seems that there is a particular gene that is more prone to, if you have this particular gene, you're less resilient to stress. And you're more prone to have cortisol being pushed out into your body and your brain when you are under pressure. So your genes, your temperament, the anatomy and physiology of your brain, and in recent years we've been able to see more what is going on in the brain, and we know that certain areas of the brain are either overactive or underactive when we are depressed. So that there's higher activity in the emotion-related parts of the brain and lower activity in the thinking parts of the brain, which fits with what you experience when you're depressed. When you're depressed, you're more emotionally sensitive, and you can't think as well. And you tend to ruminate, in other words, go over and over things in your mind. And those are the parts of the brain that light up in people who are severely depressed. Now, our understanding for a long time has been that the chemicals, these red dots here, going across between the neurons of the brain, between the nerve endings, in depression, that this chemical, the neurotransmitter, is depleted. So you use the antidepressants to increase the neurotransmitter. We also have discovered in recent years that the antidepressants also have a function of creating new neurons and increasing the activity and the connections of the neurons. And it's been found that in rats, that increased exercise and stimulation from the environment has the same effect. And one of the best self-help things you can do for depression is exercise. Certainly for myself, I exercise regularly because it helps me keeps me from going up and down in mood. Now, so we have three generations now of antidepressants. And antidepressants are helpful in severe depression. They don't act a whole lot better than a placebo. You know what I mean by a placebo. They don't act better than a placebo in mild and moderate depression. But placebos have a pretty powerful effect in depression. So people like taking pills, and when we are told this will help you and get better, whatever technique you use, whether it's giving a pill or laying on of hands and praying, people tend to get better. Now, I'm not diminishing the value of God working in people, but we are very prone to respond to suggestion. It's just the way we're made. But pills are helpful, antidepressants are helpful in really severe depression. They're better than placebo. Some people have created some humorous cartoons around this. So what I'm saying is they're most useful in severe depression, and combining them with counseling and psychotherapy is important. And there is a higher relapse rate, people going back into depression, if one or other is used alone. Now, I have a number of people who I know who have not been in really severe depression, but who have benefited from antidepressants. It's really helped them to get out of the vicious circle. So whether it's placebo effect or not, I'm not sure. Now, antidepressants do have side effects and withdrawal symptoms. So when you stop taking antidepressants, you have to come off them very slowly over weeks and months. And when you go on them, some people experience very severe, strange effects of being increased anxiety, strange sort of shocks in their head. A few people will experience this, and they may need to be changed to another antidepressant. So we juggle the dose, and we juggle the antidepressant. And some people have just very severe effects. There's a drug called Paxil, which some people call Pax Hell, because it causes them to feel like they are in hell. And then there are what we call natural remedies, like St. John's wort, that you can buy in the chemist, the drugstore. That does help in mild depression. Some people have called it nature's Prozac. But you have to remember that it does have interaction with other medications, so you have to be careful with that. I am a strong believer in fish oil for anything that goes wrong with your body or your brain. So it certainly has been shown to help people in depression. And then there are other medications that I don't have time to stop on that psychiatrists and doctors will use to help people in depression. And then we have electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, which is still used, and nobody knows quite how it works, and it sounds very primitive, but it is an effective treatment in somehow resetting the electrical conduction in the brain. And I can say more about that later if you want to. And other biological factors, you know that some people after childbirth will get, many people have just a short time of depression. Some will go into quite severe depression, and some will have a very severe depression with hallucinations and delusions. And that seems to be related to hormonal changes. Some people get more depressed in the winter and do respond to light therapy, special lights. And then there is physical illness. If you have a problem with your thyroid gland or after a stroke, quite a lot of people get depressed. Certain medications actually cause people to get depressed. So what I'm saying in all this, as I said at the beginning, it's complicated and there are many factors. And this sort of is a summary. And the more factors you have, the more likely you are to go into depression. And the more you can learn to work against the particular area of vulnerability that you have, the better. So how do we reduce our vulnerability, reduce our predisposition? Just briefly here. We can learn to talk to ourselves. That may sound crazy, but you need to learn to say to yourself, as the psalmist did, why am I getting depressed? Why am I anxious? What's the reason? What can I do about it? And then maybe talk to God in prayer, to talk to a friend, if necessary, if it gets more serious, to a pastor or a counselor. You need to learn to live with the normal full range of human emotions. Some people, if you've grown up in a family where there is alcoholism, you often don't understand your emotions very well because you've blocked them. You didn't know what to do with them. Life was so unpredictable that you would repress anger, you would repress shame and guilt and sadness. And only as you get older does it begin to come out, and it might come out in depression. So you have to learn to name your emotions and understand them. And to understand and accept feelings of grief and sorrow. So to recognize that maybe there are things that have happened in my life where I have just shut off from grief. When my sister died and my brother-in-law died, and then we moved to America. I dealt with a lot of losses at once, and I never really had learned how to deal with grief until that time. And one day it just overwhelmed me completely, and I cried for a long time. And since that time, I have learned to cry more easily when I have lost people or things, and it has been felt much healthier for me. So learning to grieve. And then as I mentioned earlier, we're sort of doing heart surgery. You're going into the person's psychological heart and you're helping them to look within and to look at their expectations and their griefs, their losses and their sin, and maybe the lies that they have come to believe about themselves, that I should never show emotion, or that I should always be in control, or I'm never good enough for God or for other people. Those are lies, and you have to make sure you define them and diagnose them as lies. So facing and dealing with a lot of these inner things, the ways that we try to dull pain in life, maybe with alcoholism or with sex, how the ways in which we are disappointed and bitter towards God, and how that has affected our choices in life. So there's healthy self-examination, and pastors and counselors can help people to do that. And this may lead you to a place where you need to come to repentance before God of your own sin, and also grief over the ways in which other people have sinned against you. You are not responsible for the way they sinned against you, but you are responsible for the way you respond to their sin. And then we need to learn to resist the devil, putting on the whole armor of God, countering the lies of the accuser with truth. We may need other people to specially pray with us when we feel particularly attacked by the evil one. We may need marriage counseling, family counseling. We may need counseling help in the leadership of the church, because quite a lot of church leaders get depressed. They get burned out. They are perfectionists and they drive the rest of their team in that way. And then, as I mentioned, exercise, I think, is incredibly important. These are what I call the common grace remedies, beyond the biblical remedies, but the way you eat. If you eat junk food, you eventually poison your brain. If you drink too much alcohol, you poison your brain. If you don't get enough sleep, that is going to make you more pessimistic and irritable. And maybe you need a little extra help with fish oil or vitamin D or other things like that. And you may need medication. If you are severely depressed, medication has value. And you need to find the right, work with the doctor to find the right antidepressant and the right dose. And realize you may have to be on it for not just a few weeks, but maybe 6, 12, 18 months. And a few people who suffer from repeated depression maybe need to be on medication their whole lives. Especially with bipolar manic depression, you need to be on antidepressants and lithium, which is a mood stabilizer, for the whole of life. And then, of course, not just medication, but meditation. And this takes us into our own relationship with the Lord in understanding who we are, as we learned last night from Glenn Harrison, that we are deeply loved, that God delights in us, and He has given us a calling and a purpose in life, to live by His instructions and to delight in His love of us. So this big picture perspective gives us the framework for life. And then, of course, prayer. As you come up out of depression, you are able to pray again. And care for others, not just being self-focused, but reaching out to help others who are worse off than yourself, is a very important thing. And then finally, I think what brings hope and healing in this is we're in all of this, we're learning to retrain our brains from the negative, depressive habits of thinking and feeling. And we've learned in recent years that you can actually change the brain by what you do and what you think. So our minds are being renewed. We're pushing back against the fall. We're being sanctified. With the image of God, Christ-likeness, is being restored in us. And we also have to learn to groan for glory. This is the future perspective of recognizing that, as Paul talks about in Romans, he says, we and the whole creation groan, waiting for the day when Christ will return and renew all things. I say to my students who are learning to be counselors, you have to learn to be a good groaner. You have to know how to weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice. So patience, hope, that perspective on suffering. Some people will be delivered miraculously and quickly from depression. Some people, it will be a long, hard journey out of those dark places of life. But we can have confidence that God is for us in this and not against us. You remember how Ruth, actually Naomi, in the story of Naomi and Ruth, after she lost so much, she lost her two sons and her husband, came back to her homeland, and she was bitter, saying, God has taken all this from me. But slowly, gradually, he restored things to her, just through ordinary events in her life. So we in this life live with sorrow and joy at the same time. Sorrow that we're in a broken world where we suffer, and joy at the fact that Christ will return and even now is giving us the beginnings of healing, even though we may not experience the fullness of that healing.